I imagine some of you maybe wish you could still be in bed, dreaming away some wonderful dream. Well, I thought I'd talk about dream today. But not so much the dreams we experience when we sleep at night, but the use of dream and dreams in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, that kind of as a metaphor perhaps, or an image, or perhaps more than even that, they use them to shake us out of our stuck views of this world and from our sense, that pervasive sense of me and everything else. Because that is really the root of our suffering, the root of our confusion, this strong boundary between me and the world. So, I thought I'd show you this. It's always nice to have a little show and tell. So this is a rakusu made by our friend and fellow priest in the Bellingham Red Cedar Zen Center, Shudo Chris Burkhart. And she made Kate one, and she made me one, very generous. If you know how long it takes to hand sew one of these, you realize that's a lovely, wonderful gift. And the back of it she left blank, and Kate did a calligraphy on mine, and I did a calligraphy on Kate's. And on this is a kind of a stylized calligraphy of a dream. A dream. Now, Kate chose her calligraphy. I chose mine. And Kate's talked about hers, I think, somewhere not too long this in the past, that her calligraphy was play, and I chose dream. And the reason I chose dream, well, there are several reasons, but kind of the main reason was I was deeply moved by the calligraphy of a priest, a Japanese priest named Takon Soho. He lived around the 1600s, so it's quite a while ago, but I have always loved calligraphy, and as many of you know, I practice calligraphy. Takon Soho was in the Rinzai tradition, very famous monk. He had enormous impact on Japanese culture. But he was also a bit of a loose cannon. He had a rebellious spirit. And there's many stories of his life, of these kind of colorful incidents that really bear witness to the reputation of him as someone you had to be kind of a little bit careful around. So for example, at the age of, I think it was 37, he was appointed the head priest, a very prestigious position, as you can imagine, of Daitokuji Temple in Kyoto. And Daitokuji is, at least at that time and still is today, one of the largest Zen temples in Kyoto. And he was appointed by a royal personage. As was custom, of course, he refused and then, you know, was more or less forced to accept. He said, okay, I'll take it. And then he quit after 3 days, having fulfilled his obligation to accept the appointment and not hurt anyone's feelings. At any rate, many stories about him. He rocked the boat almost wherever he went. But he left a number of writings that we still have today. And we know he was sought after as a Zen teacher. He had many students. And he left some very interesting and, I think, very beautiful, profound calligraphy. So, at the end of his life, the monks that were taking care of him urged him to write a death poem, as was customary at the time. Instead, he picked up his brush and brushed the character Dream, in Japanese pronounced Yume. And legend has it, then he cast aside his brush, took one more breath, and his 70-odd years of life came to an end. There's lots of stories like that in the Zen tradition. And his instructions upon his death were this. So this is writings that he left about what to do after he died. He said, "Hold no funeral service. Do not accept any funeral gifts. Secretly bury my bones at night in the mountains and never return to offer prayers. Do not make a gravestone. Do not receive for me any posthumous name from the imperial court," which is often common, right? The great, you're often named, you know, the great teacher or the country teacher, so-and-so. "Do not erect any monument, conduct no Buddhist ceremonies on my behalf, leave no traces in the chronological record." Well, that sounds pretty firm, right? Well, his students promptly ignored his wishes, erected gravestones at a fairly large temple in Kyoto called Tokaiji, and another temple a bit farther away where he was also known as a teacher. And today, Tokaiji is known as a national historical site because of the gravestone to Dai Tokaiji. Shows you how much control we have over our life and our death. At any rate, seeing his calligraphy when I lived in Japan, and then later on in books, and especially seeing the character that he wrote, Yume, this dream, he wrote it several times, not just once, but several times. It made a very strong impression on me. Because his calligraphy, and particularly this Yume, is so full of life. And I thought, how amazing for someone approaching death to choose that word. Dream. I wondered what was going through his mind at that time when he did that calligraphy. What did dream mean to him? Because I know throughout much of history in Japan and actually all throughout East Asia in general, dreams were considered quite significant and very pregnant with meaning. Just as we have that tradition in the West some places, right? But in the Zen tradition, Zen largely encouraged the turning away from seeking meaning in dreams. Not completely, but largely, you know, dreams were, not important. Get back to practice, kind of thing. And to give you an example, here's a poem by the Chinese priest, Kuishan, who was one of the early teachers of Chan, as it's known in China, or Zen, way back in the 700s. One of the great founders, actually, of the whole Zen movement. And here's his poem. "Waking from a crazy dream, a dream that feels rich with meaning, one might be inclined to analyze. Thus books are sold, experts paid. Years later, the old dream returns. But now, penniless, one just washes his face, sips her tea, stretches, and gets on with the day." And yet, despite this attitude towards dreams, as we just said in the Zen tradition, Takuan wrote Dream. Now, you'd have think he would have written something else. For example, the Japanese character kaku, which means awakening. Because its opposite, actually, is yume, dream. And the idea is that when we're asleep and dreaming, we don't really see reality clearly. So, of course, awaken. And in our everyday life, it strikes me that we frequently fall into dreamlike states. At least I do. Lost in memory, daydreaming about a possible visit, fantasizing, making plans for the day, imagining a little different life, if only I had. Caught up in a strong emotion sometimes, we get on a imaginary reaction, response. Engaged in reading a novel even, we can fall into an almost dreamlike state, watching a movie, of course. And of course, there's our nighttime dreams that we all have. And here we have Takuan, a famous, dedicated priest, all his life, from a young boy until he died, dedicated to awakening. Why didn't he leave Kaku, awakening, as his last message? In the Mahayana Buddhist teachings, and particularly in the Zen teachings, we're encouraged to look upon all phenomena as if they were a dream. And I wonder, is this what Takuan meant, perhaps? This practice of seeing everything as a dream is really to be cognizant that everything is impermanent, everything is transient, ephemeral, ungraspable. Now, because you may want to think, well, what does that mean? Well, to view this conventional world as a dream is not really unknown here in the West either, right? Perhaps you remember that popular children's rhyme, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream, merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Maybe you sung it in school as a round. We could do it here, actually. That could be one of our Zen chants. After all, isn't it a profound teaching? Life is but a dream. Like many traditional children's folk songs and nursery rhymes, the original author is unknown, of course. And according to one source I found, the earliest publication of the song dates from 1852. So it's been around for a while. It's passed through a number of generations, teaching the very young about the dreamlike nature of life. But the rhyme is a happy one in tone, right? As we merrily, 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 merrily experience a gentle life rowing with the current. Yet how often do we row with the current? Much of the time in this life, we row against the current. We struggle to row upstream through the swift and treacherous rapids of our life, pulling on our oars, desperate to control where we're going, often anxious and fearful. We keep trying to avoid the rocks and eddies by kind of turning our heads over to take a peek about where we're going as we're rowing our boat. And sometimes we're not successful. The dream becomes nightmarish. And sometimes we struggle to wake up, not even knowing we're trying to wake up. But we know there's something more, something perhaps to get away from, to open up to. It's interesting that in the Buddhist tradition actually begins with a story of awakening. As we all know, Siddhartha Gautama, as a young man living a very, very privileged life, has a short period of time when he fully becomes aware of the nightmarish qualities of life. Sickness, old age, and death, the sutras tell us. That's what he became deeply aware of. And these three qualities of life prod him to leave his easygoing life and take up about 6 years of study, discipline, and austerities, severe austerities until he finally collapses, malnourished and exhausted on the banks of the Nairanjana River, which is a tributary of the Ganges. And he decides there to abandon his austerities, realizing they're not really helpful. He received a nourishment, a milk porridge of some kind from a young woman named Sujata, and he started to regain his strength. In the Zen tradition, he is said to have sat under a tree, that today we call the Bodhi tree, for 7 days, and on the morning of the eighth, he looked up to see the morning star. And at that moment, he experienced an awakening and said, "I and all beings have awakened." Now, of course, no one else was present, so we don't really know what he actually said. But nevertheless, from that point on, he became known as the Buddha, a word in Sanskrit that literally means awakened, or that which has become awakened. It's, I think, from the Sanskrit root bud, which means to know, to awaken to. Anyway, in India at the time of the Buddha, the common view was that everyone is caught up in maya, or illusion, that the world is not as it seems to be. And based on this, many philosophies and practices arose in that subcontinent, and almost all focused on dispelling or escaping from, somehow awakening from maya. A delusion or illusion. So accordingly, Siddhartha Gautama was in some sense asleep. And then he woke up from the pervasive illusion. But I think this is the point. Siddhartha Gautama did not awaken from the dream of life, but rather he awakened in it. And then, awakening in the dream of life, everything changed. It is, I think, like to become lucid in a dream. When we become lucid in a dream, the dream is transformed. We're no longer kind of caught up in the dream. And we experience the dream without leaving it. Has everyone had a little bit of a lucid experience in a dream, perhaps, or at least you've read about it? So we could say the Buddha was one who became lucid in this world. I mentioned that in the Mahayana tradition, dreams are often discussed as images of practice and the world. So, for example, in the Diamond Sutra, one of the great and most important Mahayana Buddhist sutras, it ends with this short poem, which maybe many of you have heard before. This is Red Pine's translation. "As a lamp, a cataract, a star in space, an illusion, a dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a cloud, a flash of lightning. View all created things like this. View all created things like this." The Diamond Sutra teaches that the true dreamlike nature of all things is obscured because it poses as what we take for conventional reality of our waking life. Solid, basically unchanging, etc., etc. Something you can grab hold of, something it's mine, that thing is hers, her piece of cake is bigger than mine, etc. Sometimes we are aware that we are dreaming at night, but most of the time we are not. And in that dream, you experience yourself interacting with objects and other people, all separate from the subject, who is usually you. Although sometimes it's almost like you're watching a movie. You're not really there, but often it's, of course, you're there. And we wake up from the dream, we become aware that the dream experience all happened just in the mind. That there was no real difference in the dream between the person, the experiencer of the dream, and the dream itself. It's all happened up here. Even though in the dream we were convinced, you know, I had to escape that monster. But that monster was also in here. You created the whole thing. You were the director, producer, writer, and actors. All rolled into one. While dreaming at night, we are unaware of the distinction between me and not me. We're unaware that that distinction is an illusion created just by our brain. The monster is not me, but in fact it is me. Sounds like a paradox, doesn't it? Sometimes after a particularly vivid dream, I'm really amazed at how profoundly I accepted the dream world while I accepted. It really felt like it happened. Right? And then I get out of bed, I begin the day looking forward to meeting a friend or going over what needs to get done. And strangely, even though just a few minutes ago I took the dream for reality, I don't often question the reality of my waking life and the sense of separation between myself and the world. I just accept, of course, we're separate. So why do I hold on to this unreflective confidence that my perception of this world and life are exactly what they seem to be? Even though almost every night when I'm asleep, I'm often misled by my dreams. Accepting what happened is real until I wake up. As soon as I wake up, I think, oh, no, this is real. And I don't question it. Could it be that we just transition from one dream to another, shaking our head at how we were duped by the first, and not suspecting we are now lost in a second dream under the illusion of a separate self? And thus we find ourselves so often frantically rowing upstream, struggling for control against the flow of the world, because we see it as separate, cut off. I am often reminded that the Buddha, upon awakening, did not overcome sickness, old age, and death. He became very sick. Severe dysentery we know about because it was written in the suttas about his last days. He became very old and suffered the very things that I'm beginning to suffer. Creaky bones, and maybe he had bad memory, although that's not appearing in the suttas. Maybe he had a good memory. Yeah. Etc. And he died. So his awakening didn't change any of those things. But he was free. He was freed from the arising suffering that comes from those things and many other conditions of life. And he was freed in a very profound way. He awoke. But the conditioned world is not a dream we wake up from in the same way we leave the nighttime dreams. In awake, we come to see the conditioned world as a dream, and like a nighttime lucid dream, knowing it is a dream. The grasping and pushing away, the struggle to row upstream, to try and control, no longer quite makes sense. Hang on there. Like waking up from a bad nighttime dream, there is relief when we wake up in this world. What do we wake up from? I think we wake up from our self-centered dream. That it is really all about us, our needs, our desires, our plans, our hopes, our conditioning, our pain, etc. We wake up from that. I think we wake up from I, me, and mine. When we wake up from the I, me, and mine, the self-centered dream is no longer taken so seriously as we have done for so long. It's possible then to appreciate the greater dream, the dream that is inclusive, infinite, flowing, the vast dream that has no self and others clearly separated and defined. This vast dream, I think, is really the kind of play of shunyata, or the play of emptiness, boundlessness, the ever-changing interconnectedness of all things. We wake up to that. Dogen Zenji, the founder of this particular Japanese school of Zen, in one of his writings called Omuchu Setsumu, Dream Within a Dream, writes this. He says, awakening is expressing a dream within a dream. Awakening, Dogen tells us, is not leaving the dream, but awakening to the nature of the dream within the dream, like a lucid dream. Awakening from the self-centered dream doesn't pop the bubble of the vast dream, but the self-centered aspect no longer holds sway. Awakened, we continue to dream, but everything has changed. Now, please don't think I'm trying to describe, or that the early sutras are trying to describe, absolute reality. These are just skillful means to help us let go, to shake loose our firm conviction of everyday life is exactly as it is, as I see it. And it is true. We have moments of awakening when everything has changed. And maybe we slip back into a dream again, a self-centered dream. But we can wake up again, and that's our practice on the cushion. So I wondered, is this what Takuan was leaving for his monks with his last calligraphy of the word dream? Perhaps. But there's one more thing I want to add here about this character, Yume, or dream. Yume, another pronunciation, and this is very common in Japanese characters, the other pronunciation for the character dream is mu. And I wonder if Takuan was deliberately wrote Yume, dream, instead of the character mu, which means no, nothingness, and is often used as a synonym for emptiness or boundlessness, mo. And he deliberately chose Yume to illustrate the playfulness, the playful nature of the world that we are all woven into. In Hinduism, they talk, you know, Shiva is dancing, the great Hindu god Shiva, dancing. I think in the dance, expressing, you know, the joyful pleasure as well as the sadness of the world. So throughout his life, Thakuan returned over and over again to the truth of emptiness or boundlessness, as Kaz Ta-Nehisi sometimes translates it, a great translator of Dogen texts, boundlessness. So what does it mean to return to the truth of boundlessness of our life, that there are real no boundaries there, or emptiness? Dogen describes it like this, and a famous quote you have all heard many times here. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. When actualized by the myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the body and minds of others, drop away. The study that Dogen writes about, of course, is our Zazen practice. And as we practice, we begin to forget. What do we forget? We forget our self-centeredness. We begin to forget ourself as being the center of everything. It is ultimately the fading away and at times disappearing of all boundaries. That is our practice. No boundaries, no separations, perhaps another way of saying great love. Great love. In a lucid dream, knowing the experience is a dream, we sense that all of it, in some way, is an expression, a playful expression, perhaps, of ourself. If you've really entered a lucid dream, sometimes people, I haven't been able to do this, but people say they can manipulate what happens in a dream. And change the storyline, fly. My lucid dreams have been less spectacular than that. Thakuan's writing the character for dream is perhaps his message to us, telling us that the true nature of waking life is dreamlike in its boundlessness, flowingness, and its unity. Just over a week ago, we were in Sesshin. We were at a beautiful place in the mountains, many of us here. And we were learning about some of the stories, the koans, about nature. And we were also reflecting on many of the words of Dogen Zenji as he wrote about nature. So I'd like to end with just one quote by Dogen. That when we really wake up to the dream, this is the kind of understanding, I think, that arises. I came to realize clearly that the self is no other than the mountains, rivers, the great wide earth, sun, moon, stars. Well, I hope it wasn't too confusing for you. Dream. Well, I wish you all sweet dreams, both awake here and also at night when you sleep. Thank you very much for listening.
Page 3 of your chant book again.